Hey Dominic, thank you for coming in. We really had a lot of fun at AI for Good, which is this enormous conference in Geneva. It's the first time they had it in a number of years face to face, and it was just hugely successful. And you were part of that success. You were in the lead up to the actual conference itself as a prime contributor to the Focus Group AI for Health, which is now scaled into this global initiative. And then in the main conference, again, you were a main contributor. So, and that's because you got this great background in technology innovation and invention and just doing so much. So, thank you again for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, it was really nice to meet you during the first couple of days of the AI for Good focus group sessions. We got a lot accomplished there, which helped really prepare us to roll into a global initiative. It was a really great week and we got a lot done. And yeah, thank you so much for inviting me on to speak with you about all the great things that have been going on.
Well, it's clear at these multiple day machine learning AI workshops, you're a contributor because you're constantly providing input and thoughtful input as well. Though when I track who the majority, it tends to be pretty senior, and maybe because I've been around for so long. But the curiosity is, you got this great success. You're continuing to make these major contributions. And what shaped you, Dominic, to be this great, innovator? Maybe it was when you were like 5 years old, perhaps, or something happened in school, but there's got to be maybe two or three inflection points that, were like turning points to who you are today.
So the best way I could put it is, I was lucky in that I found a passion for technology in the middle of really the golden age of this revolution that took place in the 90s, right? So I'm 31 years old, and being born in the 1991 period, by the time I was 4 or 5, I was lucky enough to grow up on Long Island, the son of a trader that worked in the city. And, looking at the history of technology, really traders in the 90s had access to the newest, latest, and greatest computers, right? And then every 6 months they would wipe new computers off the floor and then, bring in the latest and greatest again, because things were moving so fast back then. So being younger, I always had access to computers, and I just really fell in love with the engineering of, figuring out problems and digging into the weeds of playing with things. And then, as I got older and I spent more and more time around computers, like when I was a kid, my parents used to yell at me to go to sleep at night because I would be up all night just like figuring things out and tinkering. And then that tinkering really evolved into, like a real profession, right? And I ended up going to school for video game development at Full Sail University in Orlando, Florida. And then that really accelerated me into the workforce because I took this passion that I had and the vast of knowledge that I've gained by really being in early on something. That was really transformational in the early days, right? Like in the 1995, 96 period was a very transformational time when, we were just seeing the early adopters of the internet really start circling what this would become, right? And then so by being able to really witness that, I've gained so much. And then, obviously went on to go to school for video game development, and then really, my drive, because I'm so passionate about this stuff, has been the second component. So the first component has been having the passion and also having it for a really sustained period. But then the second component has been like a willingness to just keep trying and iterating and not really caring so much about failing. And when things go wrong, they just go wrong, and then figuring out what the next steps are and working your way through that, because it's just inevitable. And so by having some of these key things that I've picked up on, and then also venturing out and trying things early on, I've learned through the failures early to be able to kind of step to that next level. And then what's ultimately happened was, in the last 3.5 years, I've been working on Drainpipe, which is the company that I founded in January of 2020. And from that period, I really took all these learnings and it helped me not only bring the best out of myself, but also put the best that I've learned into a single product. And in that time period, that product has taken me from, starting something fresh to working with some of the, leading professionals in the world in what we do.
So I'm reflecting on what you're saying then. You indicated that, you're born and raised in the U.S., but you had this good fortune of having a family member working in trading. And as you indicated, trading is really heavily integrated into technology. So you had this really early exposure of computing technology in particular, and the underlying that computing technology be things like mathematics and statistics and being able to model it, what's going on. And having that base then gave you a foundation to drive your curiosity around technology. And that curiosity and technology ended up you getting into gaming. And it's interesting, a number of years ago, I was asked to keynote a gaming conference, and I was, and it's one of the biggest conferences in the world. And when I was talking to the gamers, and I was doing leading edge stuff in my talk, and these gamers were right there, right? So gaming then would be such a great background, because you're using all of the latest tools, right? And at the edge. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to kind of succeed as a gamer. But you're succeeding as the gamer, as the gentleman that's producing the games, that's writing the underlying technology to drive these games. And then you're taking all of these learnings, as you indicated, and you create this company called Drainpipe, which has continued to accelerate your capabilities and the people you work with. And you even won awards as well. So that's a really, really fascinating background. And I saw that passion at our AI for Good workshops. You definitely are keen and you definitely have a deep interest because you're such an active contributor. So let's continue in this journey. I'll go back to Drainpipe a little bit later again, just to find out more. But how did you get involved with this focus group on AI for Health, which is this almost like a joint venture of the World Health Organization and ITU? And before we talk about how you got involved, maybe you could define what they do, and then you could talk about how you got involved.
Sure. So the AI for Health focus group that I'm a part of, and you are as well, which I saw you there, right? That focus group is a focus group where we're taking all of the top researchers in the world on many different topics in health. So you have malaria, you have diagnosis, you have dental, you have radiology, you have all of these different specific studies under the health umbrella, which can have significant impact by introducing artificial intelligence to it. And we're performing research that not only helps us understand the common factors amongst all of the different healthcare topics or the different focus groups in that topic group, right? So you have the AI for Health topic focus group, and then you have these topic groups underneath it. So like I'm a member of the AI for Radiology topic group. And so all these different topic groups contribute research, which goes into a technical documentation that contains things like, the standardization, the compliance, all of the nitty gritty of what's needed to be able to actually safely deploy an advanced technology such as an artificial intelligence into these health topics. And it's really important work because, you know, like in the case of radiology, understanding whether or not you're training an AI model to be safely used in radiology on humans is a very complicated topic. And it's very nuanced, just given how early we are in the actual math and sciences of it. And so what's really nice is that the ITU is the standardization body for a lot of telecommunication and technology, right? A lot of people, when you say AI and ITU, they get kind of confused, like, well, what does ITU have to do with AI? Well, it's, you know, by having them as the standard body that kind of helps support this. And then you have the WHO, which is, you know, kind of like they're kind of like your partner for the implementation arm of this, right? They work closely with governments to help implement or suggestions for standards. And then the ITU kind of helps develop out these standards, which then get implemented. So you have this perfect partnership of two different UN agencies that combining some of the best research that I've ever seen on these topics with the resources for implementation and then really the focus on standardizing. There's a lot of really great work that's going on. And like one thing that I would add is that this also plays in on a little bit of a higher level too, because some of the work that we do, like the work that I focus on in the focus group AI, I'm sorry, in the topic group, what is it? Yeah, it's topic group. The work that I focus on for AI for radiology has a lot to do with standardizing questions that result in us having the standard outputs for an AI model, right? So, you know, asking certain questions about what you're doing, like what kind of data you're working with, how many labels you have, just specific things in that realm, so that we can get to a standardized output of, all right, well, these are your calculations for benchmarking. Because, like, for example, for accuracy calculation, depending on what the AI model is composed of, that calculation for accuracy might be different, even though we have the same name for it. And so, you know, there's a real need for us to standardize this workflow and this process. And that's where the partnership between ITU and WHO is really a perfect marriage of these things. And that's part of why I'm involved in this, is because as a practitioner who's really deploying artificial intelligence solutions and building a business around this, I find it incredibly important that I do so responsibly. And so by being a part of the group that helps push that research forward and taking my learnings, helping to contribute that, and then also applying the learnings I can from other professionals globally into what I do, so that I can make sure that I'm deploying a solution that is done in the most responsible manner.
So that's a really interesting sort of background and narrative of what the work, what the work being done by this focus group AI for Health, which has now changed and become much more global through this global initiative. And I recommend the audience take a look at ITU and WHO and WIPO, I believe, right? The IP Association or organization of the UN, intellectual property organization, now come together to sort of expand this into a global initiative. And this is already was launched at AI for Good. But what I'm hearing is that you have this situation where the world is in healthcare and there's AI being applied to healthcare. But how do you know how good that AI is? So you're saying that you need some kind of benchmark standard that you can measure against. So then you have some idea that this application is meeting some standard, and then you have more of an assurance than seeing something in the wild come in and you don't know really, right? So that's the advantage of standards, and you see standards everywhere in the world, right? and all and different types of telecommunications. And you also
well, see- so a big yeah. component too is the Open Code Initiative,
right.
Which is where the ITU and the WHO also, you know, as part of the work that we do in this focus group or now global initiative, we have an open code initiative where code is actually deployed and open source so that other practitioners can see the way that things are being done and the way that people who have actually deployed AI solutions for healthcare are actually using it in a safe and compliant manner, right? So we actually do the work to really lead the way in providing those solutions, because it's a very complex topic. And, you know, there's not enough emphasis right now in the policy discussions at a higher level that really touch on the, you know, connecting the policy to implementation. And the implementation is very complex because it requires design considerations for things like privacy that are very unique to artificial intelligence, far beyond what we've experienced in other technical revolutions in the past.
So in this work, then, are you working with regulators as well?
That's part of the implementation phase, right? So, like, you know, we started off with the first phase was, you know, us doing the work, the research, gathering this massive amount of documentation. And they started, the actual focus group started in 2018. So they've had a lot of runtime now on this, where some incredible work has been done and incredibly detailed. And I just know that I'm completely honored to even be a part of such a special thing, because it really is a huge mark in history to even be a part of something like this, where this kind of work is being done. So, you know, they had a couple of years to get to where we are now. And then now that we're rolling this into a global initiative is where the regulation talks really start to, you know, rise to a little bit more of a priority, because now we're going into implementing this into different nation states and what have you. And that's a very complicated discussion, as you know. Like, there's a whole lot of politics involved in the whole regulation and policy making side of artificial intelligence. And, you know, we're seeing some concerns that a lot of different countries have with the EU AI Policy Act, right? And so I think it's really important that practitioners pay really close attention to this, especially from the United States. Like, if you're in the United States and you are developing artificial intelligence technologies, it's really important that you're paying attention to what's going on in Europe right now, because just like GDPR, they are leading the way in a sense, because they have a more structured package of what the standards that they're looking for should look like. Even though we're still very high level from the implementation part, it's still a more comprehensive package than what we have in America right now. And that's why a lot of my focus has been on Europe, just because of that. Because if you want to deploy something and do it responsibly, you want to look to where the hardest policy and regulations are going to be, because then when you go to deploy, everything else should relatively be either as difficult or easier.
Yeah, again, that's really quite fascinating. And the audience can find out more work by just searching for AI in healthcare and ITU. And now it's ITU, WHO, and WIPO, correct?
Yes. Yeah. It's ITU, WHO, and then the World Intellectual Property Organization. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, everybody's concerned when they share work, they don't want their work being stolen and things like that, right? So it makes sense to have the World Intellectual Property Organization in there too, because it allows for a smoother transition of, you know, work that is extremely costly to do, right? It's incredibly expensive to train some of these artificial intelligence models with, you know, your current tooling today. So, you know, this really helps to really bridge all the gaps and then bring this to that next level of focusing on implementing these solutions in areas where they're very much needed.
And the, you know, this initiative, and you're continuing to be part of this initiative as well. And it's an open process, isn't it? So that people hearing this interview can say, you know what, I'm interested in contributing. They can go to the website of this global initiative by the WHO, ITU, and WIPO and say, and sign up, correct or not?
Absolutely. And what's nice too is it nothing stops you from being able to contribute to this. You don't necessarily need to have a radiology background. Like in my case, I don't have a background as a radiologist or in medical. So a lot of my focus is understanding the actual data points that we need to make sure the model is safe. And then I contribute some additional things like, high resolution imagery compression, and areas that have impact on radiology. And then I really look at it like, radiology is one of the more complex forms of computer vision, because you're looking at something and then you need to make sure that a model can understand what it is that you're looking at and identify and match the labels that you're looking to extract from it. So it really is a very complex problem for computer vision. And that's why I really find that a fascinating subject. And I contribute some work. And then I learn a lot from dealing with the people in our group to be able to deploy these models safely in my work. And then I also apply these learnings in conversations on global regulatory policy outside of our focus groups and topic groups for AI for health, right? So, I take a lot of these conversations that we have that are very good and very rooted in research, and then I help apply these ideas in conversations with, global policymakers at the United Nations. And for example, I'm going to be a part of the AI, what is it? The Global AI Policy Summit at ETH Zurich that's coming up in November. So I'll be a part of that on a couple roundtables, having some discussions with UN policymakers as well to really help kind of bridge the gap between your policy and your implementation, because we have a little bit of a way to go on really bringing policy discussions down to earth and then implementing it and having a real structure for doing so.
So the work continues, and the audience can engage, because these are sort of open platforms. And as you mentioned, there's an open code initiative as well, as yep, that people can get involved with. And no matter what your technical background, there's some place for you as long as you're willing to contribute, right? So
absolutely.
Now, you won a bunch of awards, and I'm always fascinated when people win awards. So can you tell me more about this 2018 Red Herring North America Award?
Sure. So in my time after really entering the game industry, I spent a brief stint making slot games for casinos at one of the largest slot game manufacturers in the world. And then I transitioned to working on programmatic advertising, which are, high frequency transactions that take place, right? And so in that time period, I, did really well. I had my first company at that point, and I was, we were doing really good. And then, the programmatic advertising market got very, it got very turbulent in the 2013 to 2016 period. And it kind of caused me to have to rethink things, right? And being a first-time founder at that point, it was like really my learning lesson. And so I kind of took a step back from being at the top of the ship and captaining the ship. And I went back to software engineering. And so during that period of going back to software engineering, I kind of went back to my roots and started just, retouching in with what's happening now and what the latest and greatest is now. So I worked on some systems for real-time routing to make sure that like trucks that have like oxygen tanks on them, don't go under, don't go into a tunnel or over a bridge, and they get routed accordingly, depending on what their payload is. And then, I found myself running one of the largest producers of voice applications for like Amazon Alexa and Google Assistant in the world. And I stepped into that opportunity as an interim COO, and I revamped that company. And we were based in downtown Manhattan, and revamped it. We built out a solution for, it was a data management platform where the actual users of our solution would be able to manage their data. And then we had drag and drop, like no code options for building out voice applications and, you know, like these intelligent conversation flows to be able to deploy many different applications without having to code, which is like your early no code solution, right? So by doing that, we submitted to Red Herring, and then we, as a result of that work and building out a really comprehensive business plan, we ended up winning Red Herring North America and Red Herring Global.
Well, that's fascinating. And then you won something called the OMA Award, right?
Yeah, so the OMA Award was for deploying UNICEF's Alexa Kid Power application. So the UNICEF Kid Power for Amazon Alexa, we deployed through our company, and then that went on to win an OMA for nonprofit, which was pretty cool. And we did a lot of hard work for UNICEF to help them bring that experience that they were looking to capture into audio, because there's a lot that goes into the audio, the idea of audio, right? You have to like rebrand your brand with a sonic experience. And so that was a very complex thing to do at the time, because brands weren't really thinking about how they can engage new audiences with sonic experiences, right? And like we're going to continue to move in that direction, especially now that AI is really starting to proliferate as much, because we're going to see this new form of ambient intelligence emerge, where, you know, in the corner of your room, you have a device that's able to feed you intelligence as you're moving throughout your day. And we're going to see that more and more, especially as these language models start popping up. And just what we're seeing happen today is just, we're running in that direction.
So that's kind of a natural segue. Now, you talked about large foundation models, of which you can have diffusion models or large language models. And for the audience who aren't as technical, this could be things like Palm 2 and Bard. You could use GPT-4 and Bing AI is using that. You have Anthropic, and I guess with Claude 2 has come out. And there's the open source, right? From Alpaca to Vicuna to Orca from Microsoft. And then it's just the whole world is, and Gemini, which is being announced after you saw this sort of change within Google, where they brought the deep mind and the brain team together, and they kind of reshuffled a lot. So have you played, how much have you played with these things, and what do you think about them?
So quite a bit. So I help host the and mainly sponsor the World AI Con Festival that happens once a year in the south of France in Cannes. And the first year that we threw it, it was last year, I had the opportunity of being invited to the Meta Global AI Leadership Dinner. And when we were there, we had some of the leading researchers in the world at the time on a lot of these language models in the same room at the same dinner table. And it was fascinating to talk to them about, you know, some of the advancements that were being made then, right? So like we had, you know, Google Zurich was there. And, you know, Google Zurich plays a big part of the research team that goes into Google Brain and some of the more advanced Google research topics. And then obviously we had Meta's FAIR team there with Yanwei Kun. And it was a great dinner talking about just like where we are and where things are heading. And I've had a lot of opportunity to play with like ChatGPT and to play with these different tools. And, you know, what I really try to stress to people is that we aren't at a point where you should just trust the output. And, you know, one of the big things that came from the AI for Good week in Geneva was a lot of conversations that I had with researchers in the health space, like what we really need to do is we need to do more research on the impacts that these large language models have on individuals who suffer with like autism and things which might have greater impacts or implications by their usage of these large language models, because Cornell University had already put out some research on the fact that human heuristics for machine-generated language are flawed, which means that we can no longer differentiate whether or not a human is communicating with us or a machine in the actual language that's being presented to humans through these large language models, because they're so big and they're so dense and complex behind the scenes. They're able to communicate with word patterns that trick our brain into thinking that it's really a human behind the scenes. And when you introduce that with additional potential impacts of the person who's consuming the content, we need to understand that a whole lot better. And I don't think we've done a good enough job in really doing service to those people who suffer with these things to make them more aware of the potential impacts or harms that these language models could have.
Yeah, maybe before we get a little bit deeper into Drainpipe, maybe I can get you to predict where you think this is going to go. So if you went back a year ago, you told them that, you know what, there's a kind of intelligence out there, a machine learning intelligence that's out there. And these deep learning models and transformers are going to get to the point where, maybe we'll have some kind of AGI. And if you would have asked people a year ago, I would say the majority would say, oh yeah, 30 years out, 2050 or something. I would say the majority don't say that anymore. Or at least a significant amount say, you know what, we're going to have something that is not human, but it's sort of equivalent in many ways, maybe even better. And it's going to happen in the near term. So are you in that, no, it's still 2100, 2050, or are you now sort of, in fact, I would say it's more mainstream, right? This idea that we're there. But then if you look at Jan LeCun, he's saying we're not there. We still have to add these other sort of symbolic logic components and before we were there. So he's an outlier more now compared.
Yeah, so there's like a weird catch 22 that's taking place, because I don't think that we're going to get there with the current architecture that we have for large language models, right? So the what goes into actually making a large language model is composed of certain features and functionality behind the scenes and just a certain composition that takes this data and puts it into sequences of numbers in certain ways that I think over time we're going to start continuing to see a degradation in performance. Like there's already reports that are showing that ChatGPT is reducing in performance over time. And so as we start seeing these language models get trained more and more, I think we're going to kind of come to an eclipse of its potential, right? And then it's going to require re-architecting and rethinking about what goes into making a large language model of sorts. And I think that next generation of architecture will likely get us a whole lot closer to where this becomes, that risk conversation that people are talking about. So Jan LeCun is seemingly right in some ways, where like we're not there just yet. But I also think that we also need to be mindful of, of course, what that long-term risk looks like. But as you're also aware, a lot of people who are concerned about these risks that are, they might believe are near-term or long-term, a lot of them don't contribute to the hard problems of, being a part of working on it as a cohesive unit. A lot of people want to lead the way rather than contribute. And that's also problematic, because like look at the AI for good topic group and focus group that we have, right? That focus group anyone can join and anyone can contribute to. And, you know, the people who have concerns about these things really ought to consider joining and contributing their concerns so that they can be worked through and studied.
Yeah, I mean, and we're living it, so we'll see what happens. I just want to trigger off now. You said earlier that you were embedded into this AI Cannes festival or summit, and you were what, a sponsor as well?
Yeah, so we sponsor the World AI Con Festival every year. So we're one of the foundational sponsors from the very first year, and now we're going on our third year. So we'll be there again coming up February of 2024.
That's remarkable, because that summit, is it a summit or a festival?
It's a festival where all of the top artificial intelligence companies, a lot in Europe because it's kind of Europe heavy, but all the top companies in the world really come together. And it's a couple of days of just really good expositions. And then really good keynotes. You know, we have all the top people that show up. I know Jan was there a couple of years in a row. We've had, just everybody, anyone you can name. I know Stuart Russell has been there a couple of times. It's a great event.
You know, and it came onto my radar too. So it's interesting that I didn't realize you're the foundational sponsor for these things. And because, I help with AI for good and sponsor, you need sponsors. And anchor sponsors are the ones that take all the risk initially, right? Yeah. When you're launching these things. So kudos to you for saying, you know what, I'm going to put myself and my company behind this thing. And now it's become quite a famous, conference festival, right? So
yeah, it's also a really special moment for me as well, like on a real personal level as a founder. I go through a year's worth of work of, backbreaking work, 20 hours a day, just going nonstop. And then, it's the one week of the year that I really celebrate all of that work coming together to form a great show and a great presentation. And to be able to really engage with audiences that are interested in these topics. And so, usually that week I have a lot of speaking engagements, usually three or four, and I'm running around the building like a chicken with their head cut off, just trying to keep up with everything. And it's really nice because it's also, I've made special friendships from it. When you had asked earlier how I really got involved in the AI for radiology work, it really came from our presence at the World AI Con Festival the first year, because at that Meta Global Leadership Dinner, I happened to meet the topic chair for radiology at that dinner. And then, we had spent some time talking as well in our booth, which we have a fantastic booth every year. And so, that interaction, that sequence of interactions later led to being invited to contribute to some of this work.
Now I can see all of these threads sort of coming together. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Drainpipe. So you created this operating system for managing data and training large-scale AI models, and it's pretty innovative, and there's underlying mathematics, and it's a neurocomputing platform. And it allows any user, doesn't matter what their background or skill set, to simulate complex scenarios and manage AI models in rapidly changing environments. So, and I know there's this context, your research includes these heterogeneous hierarchical modeling and et cetera, et cetera. How did this come about? How did Drainpipe come about? And where do you hope to see this go? And who really is the audience for Drainpipe?
Sure. So, of course, the story is not lacking any action. So the way it started was early of 2020, January, I was the director of programmatic trading for a programmatic advertising company in New York City. And at the time I was managing some of the largest web properties in the world. So managing the sales of ads on these websites. I mean, some of them included like Associated Press, you know, you name it, the biggest platforms in the world that display ads to end users. I was managing them through my desk. And at the time I was like really struggling because like I'm looking to push myself further and harder and, you know, to accelerate and grow and really find my groove in life of like that thing that I'm really good at. Right. And so, you know, one day I was sitting at a local establishment and a good friend of mine happened to just like grab my shoulder and said, "Hey kid, if you could build anything in the world, what would it be?" And I told him, I'm like, "Look, right now, the way I see things going, we're going to have a huge explosion of artificial intelligence any minute. We're on the cusp of it. You know, 2020 was a little bit before, but we were on the cusp of it then. And I'm like, it's happening without a doubt. It's just a matter of when. And what I'd like to do is create a platform that's done right, that doesn't follow the standard conventions of doing things the same old way, but allows for any user, regardless of their background, they don't need to be a data scientist, to be able to ingest information into their platform, which is stored securely, and drag and drop visual tools to be able to actually build out an AI model and train it and understand whether or not it's safe, and then connect it to all their streaming data and their different accounts. And, you know, it could be bank accounts, it could be anything that they want to connect, where they want to really capture the value in their data and really understand what's going on and then really enhance their life with the tools of having their own artificial intelligence models securely stored on their devices. So that was the goal. And I said that to my friend in a very limited way. And he's like, "Hey, if you could do that, I'll back you." And so we wrote the idea on a bar napkin and, it went from there. And so from there, he had given two requirements. One was I had to validate this idea with a technology professional. And then the second one was having patentable subject matter to be able to really like get this thing off the ground. So he ends up bringing someone to the table who was actually the former systems admin of NASA's Numerical Aerodynamics Simulator. So essentially what this guy did was he simulated air for NASA, so that back in the 80s when, you know, they needed to simulate a rocket going up rather than send it up and waste $100 million and see it blow up, they would simulate it on these numerical aerodynamic simulators to see how it would fly and then collect all of this data, which is tremendous even in the 80s, and then learn from it. So I spoke to this man. He said, "Hey, you're thinking about this problem the right way. And you're going to be able to scale the models the way that you want to scale them to be like, you know, not just 2 or 3 gigabytes of data, but really like push the bar many steps forward to the, you know, to the petabyte scale of building large artificial intelligence models." And so this man, of course, said, "You're not allowed to use any language that does automatic garbage collection." So that meant that we really had to focus on efficiently designing software that could run on hardware to be scalable. And so it really started this journey, almost like an expedition in computing and technology, where I had to really go back to the roots of innovation and think about these problems very differently.
Interesting. So you got initial almost angel investment, right?
Yep.
And have you raised subsequent rounds then? How did that go?
So we're actually like this week and next, we're in the middle of closing that. And I can't wait to announce like the way that that's all going to work out. But there's some incredible things there that are happening here at Drainpipe. But so what ended up happening was, you know, from January, only 2 months later, COVID really happened, right? And a normal investors would have been incredibly scared because they just obligated to start this new thing with, you know, with the kid wearing the Yankee hat. And and so the normal person would have been a little bit freaked out, whereas my angel investor was really supportive. I've actually like walked everywhere. Like I stopped driving. I gave up everything in my life, got really thin in my spending and just really made this happen by walking it out, by doing all the hard work, and worked all throughout COVID. And in September of 2021, we hired the former chief architect of Teradata. His name is Felipe Carino. He's also, a major contributor of distributed computing research in the central France, southern France area, right? So like before I was born, he was going to Sophia Antipolis to give talks about distributed computing. And that region of the world is one of the hotbeds for the work in distributed computing. So like, Paris in 1992 and 91, they were hosting Parlay conferences on distributed computing principles, right? So, interestingly enough, I had the opportunity to hire this man and bring him on board and have him validate our work. And so he came on board, saw the work that was done already, and he called it a miracle and was like, this is incredible. And he was just blown away by the scalability of it all. And so he came on, validated it. We continue to work really closely even today. He's a really good man, and I have a whole lot of respect for the work that he's helped lay down. And not enough people in what we do have an appreciation for the history of technology. And that's really important if you're going to know where to go in the future. You really have to understand where what the basis and the roots are for all the work that's behind us too, right? So he ends up sticking around. We go to the First World AI Con Festival, and then really only 2 days after getting back into the United States, had a nice barbecue with my angel investor, and then he suddenly passed away. While he was really excited about just all the progress that we had made, because we just literally went from an idea on a bar napkin to standing on the biggest stage in the world talking about artificial intelligence and talking about the work that we did from the starting point to then. And after that, it picked up a lot of traction. And then it was also a very difficult year last year, dealing with losing, quite possibly one of the most impactful people I've ever met in my life, because he was really one of the first people that really trusted me with that responsibility of building something to this capacity. But that fire in me really started roaring to really push this to the next level. And then that's when things really, got to that next level of, that's why you saw me in Geneva, because I harnessed all of that emotion into, building more and buckling in and just getting more done and focusing. And as a result, it's made me more and more prepared for these very difficult discussions and very difficult situations, where these are very impactful conversations I have every day.
And then you received this Global Top 50 AI CEO in 2021 as well, right? From Technology, yes. Innovators Magazine. So,
yep. So that was, because a lot of the work we're doing is rooted in distributed computing methodologies. So unlike standard artificial intelligence technologies today, this is a distributed platform. So when you deploy Drainpipe, it's made to be distributed over multiple devices. So it's not a centralized solution like everything else is today. So in doing that, it really required a lot of that distributed computing methodologies. And, that's actually the same thing that is why the French and Italian government really invited us to start sponsoring the World AI Con Festival on the first year, because they caught wind of it. They saw the work we were doing, and then they they reached out and gave us the opportunity to take part in these events.
So it sounds like you already have an MVP, and it's do you have clients right now? Or
yeah, so we work with a whole range of different clients. Some of them are in the healthcare space, where they use our software mainly for back office stuff. That's just for like managing data flow and triggering events. We also have customers in the digital advertising space that are using us to run digital forensics on ad transactions to determine whether or not ad fraud is taking place from like bot networks and things of that nature. And then we also do, like, I do a lot of consulting work in, the public sector as well. So in America, I deal a lot on the federal side of things, from architecting to implementing.
Well, it's, you know, a remarkable journey that you have. And, you know, and we talked about how your research includes heterogeneous hierarchical modeling, you know, which transfers emergency management, human relief, humanitarian relief, AI for healthcare, and so on. We've covered a lot of the sort of the background of what you're doing. And we're down to the last minutes of our interview. And I only have one other question. And that question is, what are your recommendations to the audience?
So my recommendations to the audience, the best thing I could actually say, and this has been kind of a common theme, but I really want to put this out there. And that's that, you know, we all live a very unique life with a very unique background that's unique to us. And since we're in this time period where, you know, we all need to contribute to these topics that we're discussing, right? So to the topic of artificial intelligence, since we're all from a different background, we all really stand to gain by contributing in any way that we can, rather than just kind of dismissing it to the experts. We all need to kind of step up and contribute what we know to this, because it really will help in the long run if we have more inclusivity of people from all different walks of life and people from all different backgrounds. And I don't think it's a good idea for us to leave all of the answers that can be to the few, to the select experts, because things are moving at such a pace that it's even hard for the experts to keep up at this rate. And so we all need to kind of step up and contribute where we can.
Yeah, that's very sound advice, right? Get involved in some way, be part of the voice, or have your voice be heard, right? Yeah. And the way technology is today and all the platforms available, everybody can contribute. So you can be part of the conversation. So, you know, Dominic, thank you for coming in. Just a really interesting interview. It was great to spend this time and kind of mine all these different aspects of what you do. You know, I work with a lot of entrepreneurs and so on, and you have all of these elements that are key for successful entrepreneurs, and that's grit. And grit is this sort of hard work and perseverance and having optimism and just keeping at it again and again, of course, and then developing skill sets and so on. So you have all of those. So thank you for sharing your journey with me.
Thank you so much for having me on, and thanks for the amazing questions. It's been an honor to spend this time with you and to speak with you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.